I want to start just with an observation. Right. I want to start with an observation. And that is that I always admire what you do here as volunteers in the museum. But I have to tell you that sometimes I wonder how you do this and volunteer here at the Holocaust Museum. Because I could tell you that in preparing this talk, I'm finding it increasingly difficult. It's becoming more and more, I've had this as the years go on, and it's becoming more and more difficult to prepare these lectures, because I'm finding that it is becoming more and more emotional and more overwhelming. And I'll give you an halachic, a Jewish law analogy to explain what I'm experiencing, and maybe you have some insight into this. There is a law, there is a principle in Jewish law called Panim Chadashos, which is translated into English as, literally means, new faces. Panim Chadashos means that when you encounter a new face, that sharpens your emotional experience. So for example, if you attend a Jewish wedding, they recite, traditionally, generally speaking, at a standard wedding, the groom and the bride never been married before, they recite seven blessings, and they have 7 days of celebration. Those are called Sheva Brachos. Seven blessings, and then 7 days of celebration. Well, the seven special blessings that are recited at a wedding, we call them the Sheva Brachos, are also recited during the course of the week, when you have a festive meal, and when you have what's called Panim Chadashos, when you have a new face. And the reason for that is because when you have somebody who hasn't yet participated in your occasion, it makes it more festive that you have a new person. And the same thing was true years ago. Why don't you put this Michelle there, please? In a different context, it's actually the opposite but parallel, and that is in the context of mourning. In Jewish tradition, there are 7 days of mourning. Traditional mourning services, observances are 7 days. It's not surprising that it parallels the 7 days after a wedding. Those are two transformational emotional events. So you have 7 days to emotionally cope with or adjust to your new reality. So in traditional, 1,000 years ago, in traditional houses of mourning, actually, in many places, the rules and the customs of that mourning house would differ if someone new came to visit. Why is that? Because it would arouse more feelings of grief. And many of us have experienced this. You go to visit somebody at a Shiva house, and you walk in, or they see someone who walks in who's an old friend, who knew their parent, or knew the person who passed away. And it just, you know, that person starts to get emotional again. They weren't emotional 5 minutes ago, but when the new person walks in, that's Panim Chadashos. And it brings up that emotion. So what I'm struggling with is that the more that I research and I prepare, it is like Panim Chadashos. The overwhelming nature of this topic of studying and thinking about and researching and preparing talks about the Holocaust, every time it's like Panim Chadashos. And because I'm looking for new material to share, you just uncover more sadness and endless grief. It's mamish kasha ma'od. It's so difficult. So I don't know how you go about dealing with this. And maybe it's because I'm looking for new things and that makes it more difficult. And maybe it's because I'm still younger. But I don't know what it is. But I am still struggling with this. And it becomes more and more difficult as I'm looking for new ways. So I don't know if anybody has any thoughts. Who wants to go first?
I do have further.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I speak personally, and I don't know if I can speak for the rest of the room, but I think it is a difficult topic. I think a lot of us go through the same thing.
So I'm sharing that with you because it's an experience that I'm having that I've seen over, you know, thank God, many of us in this room, it's been several years that we're doing this, and I'm finding as I'm opening new chapters, I'm finding it to become more difficult. So we have to, you know, we have to just try to I don't know, find ways.
There's always going to be loss.
Right. But the of course, as you talk about the magnitude and the deeper you delve, the enormity of the brutality also. You know, that's one of the things that's interesting about the museum, because it has to be an open environment for lots of different kinds of people. It does not, and even the Washington Museum, which of course is much larger than our museum, it does not even scratch the surface of a fraction of the enormity of what that type of brutality was. Mamish, it doesn't even open the door. You know, so it's just something that I'm thinking about, that I'm sharing with you. Maybe this itself is cathartic to tell you that it's a challenge. But yeah, Ina, what are we going to say? Then we'll get to today's topic.
Because often we sit around and talk, and by exchanging the points of view, I think that we do. But coincidentally, about, 45 minutes ago, Rachel and myself and Gina were in the lounge over bagels, and we were talking, oh my God, we're always so exhausted after this, and how this is really difficult to do. And part of it, I mean, we have to be on, Rachel, so we have to be on. But what's coming to mind now, as you're bringing your feelings out, is maybe part of our exhaustion is that we are so passionate and that we are so steeped in this story, that having very similar experiences and feelings as we walk through with our students. And you know, the fact is that I find myself often in my tours, I have to throw out a provocative thought, and I'll say something, and I tell them, I don't really want an answer, I want you to think
about it.
But sometimes I'll say to them also, after saying a statement, if you can tell me, if you can explain this to me, please do. And I'm sharing how I'm emotionally involved, and how I am overwhelmed, and putting it on, wanting to draw them in. And so, wow, I mean, thank you for sharing your feelings.
Look, that's what it is sometimes.
In a different way, because not at your level, but...
No, we're...
And it's also nice that, because we all do this, we can all talk about it, and we can all support each other.
We are blessed, Baruch Hashem, thank God. We are actually moving in a couple of weeks to a new house about 3 blocks from us in Skokie. And so as I was preparing, like, half my books are boxed, and I'm like, and I'm sitting there. It's like a very tumultuous situation. So I'm going to share with you today a dilemma. And this is one of the main ethical dilemmas that you have explored, probably, through your tours and your research, and that endless pages and countless inkwells have been spilled over this dilemma and many hearts broken. And we're not going to solve this dilemma, and we're not going to survey all the sources, but I want to look at some sources to inform one of the most painful dilemmas that Jews faced during the Holocaust, most notably in the context of Judenrat, but not exclusively, because it existed in other permutations as well. And that was the question of handing over Jews to the Germans. Selections. The Germans come to, you know, and then just fill in the name. There are more controversial, like Rumkowski in Lodz, probably the most controversial. Historians have a lot to say about him. But others, in lots of different circumstances, were faced time and again with the same question. Germans would come and they would say, give us either X number of people or this specific group of people, turn them over or else. What's going to happen to them? So at different stages in the war, there were different realities that they knew about. Early, you know, before the concentration camps that turned into death camps were really big and operational, so maybe there were gas vans, maybe there were forests, you know, it was somewhat unclear. Once you move deep into 1942, 1943, most people knew. They knew what was going on. So how does a person make that kind of assessment? And what's the right decision? So to think about this, a couple of sources come to mind. And if you want to do some on your own reading, here are two places to look. The first one is in a book that we've talked about before, and that is Esther Farbstein's Hebrew, B'sei Saram, what's it called in English?
Hidden
in Thunder, thank you. Hidden in Thunder by Esther Farbstein. She has a whole section on this in the first volume, chapter 4. A whole, what's called One Jewish Life. Esther Farbstein, Hidden in Thunder, chapter 4. A huge survey of this. Another place you can look is in this volume called Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil, in the final volume, in volume 4, called The Final Solution. Here they also have a big section. And then, this book, which is not an easy book to get a hold of, and it's also written in very complex modern Hebrew, so you better buckle up before you try this one on for size, but it's a really great survey of a lot of these issues and responses and the history and the halacha. It's called V'hasnene Einenu Ukal, which in English is translated, and the bush was not consumed. That's the title of the work, and it is looking at halachic Jewish law topics from the Holocaust period, and he devotes scores of pages to this topic. The chapter is called Po'alon Shel Mo'atzot HaYehudim V'Shutfeihem, the activities of Mo'atzot HaYehudim, which means the Jewish councils, we call the Judenrat, and their partners. That's literal translation. So he has a whole lengthy chapter. So these are, the author is Yecheskel Shraga Lichtenstein, Rabbi Dr. Yecheskel Shraga Lichtenstein, who's a professor in Bar Ilan. I don't remember where I was. I must have been at Yad Vashem where I found this book. So I just needed to buy it, and now it's...
Is that put in Hebrew?
Yeah, this book is only in Hebrew. I don't believe there is an English edition. So there are...
What was Esther's last name?
Farbstein. Farbstein, you can get it online. You can get it in the local bookstore. Yeah, get it on Amazon. Two volume set. Really, really worthwhile secondary volume. Outstanding.
Hard to read. Like, emotionally.
Yeah, it's outstanding. Nah, she doesn't need my approbation, but it's an outstanding volume. Scholarship, can't beat it. And I would say it's relatively easy for scholarly works. It's relatively easy to understand, very accessible in English. So, there are a lot of discussions about this question. And the way that I'd like to look at it is instead of looking at historical specifics, which in both of these works, in the Farbstein work and in this work from Yad Vashem, Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil, they talk about specific people and specific ghettos and specific circumstances where they were faced with these questions, and we'll bring up some of those stories in a little bit. But I'd like to take a step back and say, well, on what basis did people make these decisions? How do you go about making a decision like that?
It's not easy.
Right. Yeah. It's not easy.
This would give me an answer.
Yes.
So people have looked, and I'm kind of digressing, but it isn't, when there is short resources,
yes,
and rationing is necessary. For example, in Toronto during the SARS epidemic, they had set up a system of rationing as who would they interested. So.
Yes. And let me hear it, Maurice.
Very similar.
Great.
And they set up a system. I could bring it in. What? How they? How many years you have? They looked at certain professions. Well, if you don't help the policemen, firemen, and doctors and caregivers, then what's going to happen? A nursery school. Who will take care of? And so that was an occupational thing. Then it was a thing of related to how many years you might get in return for being on a ventilator. If you're 80, you might only get 2. If you're 20, you get 40 years. And they had a whole system set up, and triage officers, the Judenrat in the emergency room, to make these selections.
Okay, perfect.
So it's rationing, and it happens.
Yes.
Whenever resources... Now
great,
case,
the scarcity of resources. Perfect. So I want to come back to my point in 1 second. I want to follow up on Maurice's point for a second. Then I'll come back to the general point that I wanted to get to. And that is that the question of triage and prioritizing is an important one that comes up in other contexts as well. But one could say yes, that's a good model, and one could argue maybe there's a different model. Maybe. Okay, the question I would raise is there a distinction or is there not between the triage question that you're describing, which has to do with saving lives, versus the question of handing over someone and sending someone to their death? Are those the same?
No.
So that's a question. So now let me get back to where I was going to go, and then we're going to come back to you. If you were living in Eastern Europe and you were an observant Jew, you were part of a tradition, an age-old tradition that dates back thousands of years to the giving of the Torah at Sinai. It is an unbroken chain of tradition, of transmission. That was the Hebrew year 2448. Now we're in the year 5778. Unbroken chain of tradition. Moses received two books, I guess you could call it. One written book and one unwritten book. The written book was the text that we have of the five books. And the unwritten book was a set of traditions and rules of interpretation and methodology of how to analyze and infer rules from that book. That was passed on for centuries until the period of the Roman persecutions, when things were exceedingly difficult for Jews in the second and third centuries in Israel, where rabbis recognized that the oral tradition could no longer remain oral. Because of the intensity of the persecution, it was in danger of being lost. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the third century decided that he needed to write down cliff notes of the oral tradition, which is what we call the Mishnah. And that began the process of what we have now, which is a world full of Jewish halachic religious literature. It started at that process in the third century. That kind of developed into an expanded edition called the Talmud, which explains and applies and embellishes and analyzes all the different teachings in this cliff notes called the Mishnah. And those Talmudic teachings, they were then later analyzed by commentaries over centuries and applied in various generations. So if you were a Jew in a traditional community, you would say there's something called halakha. Halakha literally means the path, the way of going, the way, the traditional way of Jewish going. And that was set out by thousands of years of rabbinic footsteps from those two traditions, the written tradition and the oral tradition. That would be where you would look. And this is what rabbis did and Jews did, many observant Jews in various different circumstances throughout the Holocaust. And many of them, and this is part of why the halakha is so alive even today, they looked at the same sources that we're going to look at from 800 years, 1,000 years, 1,500 years ago, and we can look at them with the same set of eyes and analyze them. Now, of course, when you have a rabbi who has dozens and scores of years of experience and breadth of knowledge, his analysis is oftentimes better informed. It's always better informed, and it's oftentimes more on the mark. But what I'd like to do is to look at four sources that those rabbis were looking at in the Holocaust, and that's why when you read these discussions in English, they all come back to the same sources that actually provided the conceptual framework of how to analyze a question like this. Yes?
Before you discuss this,
yes.
I want to comment on what Mori said.
Yes.
If we believe that every human being was created equal, how can you choose one over the other?
Oh, great question. Right? Pierre's asking a very profound... What would you say to that, Maurice?
You're talking about a moral and ethical question. And there comes a time, and sometimes you have to set some of these principles aside to save more. I mean, I think there is a time when you look back and you've made a decision. I'm sure these people... And you say, I have to set this principle that I've lived all my life aside in order for the greater good.
So this is going to be the question. Because we certainly do that if you have two people who are drowning in a river, and you can only save one of them, so there, the moral and ethical dilemma is much easier. What are your choices? Of course, you're going to try to save one of them, which is your ability. And so then, there is a traditional text called a Mishnah in Maseches Horios, the Tractate Horios, which discusses if you had to choose, you know, the high priest versus an ordinary person. It discusses the principles of triage. The challenge is here, and this is what you're kind of alluding to, it's a different picture. It's not saying it's a question of triage, I can only save one. It's a question of, do I have the right to be, quote, and I'm using this term with quotation marks, advisedly, complicit, active in saying this person goes on the list. Are those the same or are they different? So I want to take your attention first to this source sheet.
Did you talk about this before when they were deciding who to send to America?
So that was, yes, that was kind of a similar, and it kind of touches on that question in terms of the Van Hatzolah trying to rescue Lithuanian rabbinic figures. Yes. So there too, it definitely is related to this.
But it's
a slightly different category. Then
so,
I want to go to the...
So yes and no. I think, you know, in the beginning of the war, when there was still an unknown, it was a who stays... Right, and who gets sent into the unknown, and they didn't know what it was. They were being told it was for a camp, an easier camp for women and children and elderly people and whatever. So in the end, I'm viewing it more of, we're all going to die, so it's not necessarily sending to death and keeping. It is, I can save this group and not this group. So it's like if you think of two groups in the river, everyone's in the river. At the end of the war, we're all in that river. And so is it the ability to save this group, not send that group to the death?
Okay, yes. And maybe you could think of a third in-between scenario, which is even later in the war, when they knew that the people who were being deported were going to be gassed in Chelmno or Auschwitz or Treblinka, whichever they were going, is it that they're both going to die, or is it that people are going to die, they will definitely die, and the people that are here, maybe they'll survive the war, maybe the Russians will come. So it's even the further complication. And that, now, I'm not sure if you read the fourth chapter and are just trying to spill the beans.
No, it's been a long time.
Okay.
So I have no reference.
It's good, fine. I'm not accusing. But I will say, by the way, that that is one argument that Esther Farbstein points out in her book. When she does the full analysis of this question, she points out that oftentimes you will hear one rabbinic response, and the reason for that rabbinic response, and generally that was, I'll give you the answer now, that was generally a more permissive response. That was often, as she points out, in contexts where the resettlement was not, at that time, a clear and certain death sentence.
Yeah.
As opposed to later on, where she points out that the rabbis who ruled in those cases would not necessarily, you can't say for sure, because they didn't survive to see that, or they didn't have that circumstance, but she points out that that is a big distinction that needs to be drawn. So now let's look at these passages. Yes.
Is there really a difference
between the two cases? Let's take a look. We're going to take a look.
I was going to say, you pick people that will survive and send the other ones off. But you're really committing, you're saving these and you're sending the other ones to death. Or, in a triage situation, one is you're committing people to life, and the other one you're committing people to death, but they're both, you're doing the same thing, only you can kid yourself that I'm doing it for good. When I'm in the triage room, I'm saving these people, and I'm saying these other people put in the side room, and I'm committing them to death. It is the same thing as saying, these are the people who I'm putting on the list.
But the people that you commit triage to, you don't know if they're going to survive. You think your technical skills are going to make the difference between...
They have a chance.
They have some chance. Also, they might have a chance on the other side as well. Not maybe as good. Yeah, they're not as good. But let me tell you, to say that triage is successful down the line, forget it, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. So but I'm just saying, you're committing yourself to saving these people and putting these people in the side room, and we're not going to operate on those. They have no chance of surviving. Is that any different than taking these people and putting them on a list, and these are the people I'm sending off? You're kidding yourself. You know.
I guess
emotionally, you're kidding yourself. I'm operating on these people to save them. Don't bother me with the people that are going to die that I've kind of committed to being on the Uber-on list.
I hear exactly where you're going. And let me give you an example that actually expresses the sentiment in particular. And this is that there were several cases that are documented of rabbinic responses regarding the following question. Can I bribe someone to get my son out of a condemned barrack when we know that the cop is going to take somebody else?
Can I buy a kidney on the open market when I'm really not on the list to get a kidney?
Okay, I'm not sure that those. I'm not sure those are analogous. I think those are.
But my son's going to die, and I have enough money and wherewithal where I can go and get a kidney.
Right, but I'm not sure that those. Exactly, I'm not sure you're condemning someone to death if it's on the open market.
Somebody on that list is moving down, and you know. Anyway,
maybe,
I don't
maybe, so, maybe, but yeah. What were you going to say?
I still have,
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there a law or something that, like, that you're committed to take care of yourself and your children first before? Am I wrong?
There you go. Okay. So you're familiar with this passage in the Talmud in Bavli Metzia?
Yeah.
There you have it. We have Talmudic scholars here.
No.
You're not a Talmudic scholar?
Slowly studying.
Got it. So there is a tractate called Bava Metzia, the middle gate, where they describe a debate between two sages. And the primary sage in that discussion is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is arguably one of the greatest of the Talmudic and Mishnaic sages. And the discussion is regarding a cup of water, a jug of water. Do I drink or do I share? So the context of that case of Rabbi Akiva and another man by the name of Ben Petura is I have the jug of water and I could share it and there won't be enough for both of us, or I should keep it. So Rabbi Akiva says in that case, I should keep it. But there is another interesting discussion in Masechet Sanhedrin, Tractate Sanhedrin. Let's say somebody were to come to you and say, you need to kill that person. And if not, I'm going to kill you. What's the law in that case?
Take the bullet.
That's right. You got to take the bullet. Because the Gemara has an expression, who says that your blood is redder than their blood? And now this is going to start to come back to Maurice's point, which is, well, maybe there's a difference, and there's a big discussion among later authorities about what would be in the following case. The authorities would say, okay, there's a small child there, God forbid, a 2-year-old child. And they would say, well, you can either take a bullet or you're going to take this grown 300-pound adult, we're going to drop you on that child, and that will suffocate the child to death. So in that case, you're not the subject of the murder, you're the object, you're the weapon. Is that a different story? And many authorities say yes, because you're not committing the murder, you're just the implement, you're just passive. So this is a very complicated, long discussion. Let's get back to the sources that I have for you. This actually, I use this source sheet builder called Safaria, which I don't usually use, but oh, you like it. It's a very nice resource that I use this time. So there are two Mishnaic traditions. One is part of the Mishnah, which is in this source number one, which is in Maseches Trumos, Tractate Trumos. It's in the context of a group of people who are being accosted by bandits, and the bandits say, give us one of your women. So the Mishnah says, if not, we're going to defile all of the women. The Mishnah says, in that case, yitamu eskulam. They should all subject themselves to defilement, and they should not hand over one of the women. So already, by the way, you see that in, at least in this circumstance, the question of, you know, the results and the numbers does matter. You learn from this that you don't have the right to single out one person to be handed over, even if it will save the many. And that's what we expand on, just 1 second here, in the Tosefta, which is a traditional text written at the same time as the Mishnah, 3rd century, same rabbis, different corpus of learning. In this case, it's Siyah Shel Bnei Adam. You have it in the English on the left side. It's the Sfaria translation. Sha'am Olam Nachrim, that the Gentiles said, Tnu lanu echan mikem v'nahargeyu. Give us one of your people, and we will kill them. And if not, v'im lav, hare anu horgin es kulan. We will kill all of you. What's the ruling? They all have to die. Yes?
Just as a slight intervention, I'm curious to know what that would say if there was one woman who stepped forward and said, I will.
Okay, now, great question. Well, willingly, on her own.
But let me finish my
question. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so let's assume, first of all, you don't know if you could trust them that they will.
That's, we don't know if we can trust
them.
That's
a big problem. But is it incumbent upon the rest of them not to allow one woman to step forward? So I think there are many questions.
You are right. Well, I can envision. Let me come up with a hypothetical. Let's say maybe all Jews are in danger. Let's say they're at risk of all being annihilated in some Persian kingdom a very long time ago, and there's one woman who maybe has the ability to influence the king.
Esther.
Ah! Give that, you know, when we would go to baseball games as kids in Oriel Park at Camden Yards, the Orioles games, so whenever a fan would catch a foul ball, we would say, Rex Barney, I think he passed away, Olav Shalom. He was the announcer in Camden Yards. So he used to say, give that fan a contract. So give that fan a contract. So that is one of the big rabbinic discussions. Let's say the person is willing to volunteer and give themselves up. Well, is Esther the model? Or maybe Esther is different. There's a difference between literally a decree that will actually annihilate all the Jewish people, or there's a difference between your local group of 10 guys who are walking in the desert. It's a good question. These are all important questions. So now this Tosefta, which appears there also in Trumos, says there is a caveat. See on the 5th line, Aval im yichadu lahem kagon sheyichadu l'sheva ben bichri yidnu lahem va'al yehargu. However, but if they designated one person, for example, the case of Sheva ben Bichri, which we'll talk about in a few moments, then you give that person over, and not everyone is subjected to death.
Is this martyrdom?
So it's definitely martyrdom, no question. And this is why we view all the Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust as kedoshim, as holy martyrs, whether they were religious, not religious, whether they had the intent of martyrdom, they died for the sake of Kiddush Hashem. So now take a look on page 2, top of the next page. We have, as you know, two Talmuds. We have the Jerusalem Talmud, the Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud Torat Eretz Yisrael, what's called the Talmud Yerushalmi, and then we have the Babylonian Talmud. So on this discussion, the Talmud Yerushalmi, and this is my free translation, describes the same scenario, and it describes a debate. Last 3 lines. Reish Lakish said, V'hu sheyeh chayav misa kesheva ben Bichri. The only time where you put this person over to the hands of the Gentile marauders is when he is liable for capital punishment. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan says, even though he is not liable for death, like the case of Sheva ben Bichri, you still hand him over. So we had one source that discussed handing over a woman. Then we had the Tosefta that said you should not hand over one man. The Tosefta then gave us an exception, the case of Sheva ben Bichri, and two ways of reading that exception. What is the case of Sheva ben Bichri? So this is a case that if you look in the prophets, Nevi'im, in Shmuel Beis, Samuel 2, chapter 20, what happens in that discussion? Some of you are familiar with the Davidic kingdom. It suffered some tumultuous periods, you could say. You know that David HaMelech, King David, for a brief period, was chased out of Jerusalem by his son, the rebel Avshalom. Avshalom sends David into exile, tries to go after him. King David eventually quells the rebellion. After he quells the rebellion of Avshalom, there was one guy who says, his name is Sheva ben Bichri, I'm not interested in David, I also want a revolt. Not the best idea after King David just quelled a rebellion. Not the best son either, but not the best idea. So David's officers, led by his chief general by the name of Yoav, they find out that Sheva ben Bichri is in a city. They come, they lay siege to the city. And they basically, you know, they have one of those foghorns. They say, guys, I have good news and bad news. The good news is we're here from King David. Bad news is we're going to kill every one of you in the city. You're all dead. Because treason is a capital crime. Morid b'malchus. So, as is often the case, there's one wise person in this city who comes up with a brilliant idea. It's a woman, of course, who is very wise. And she comes to the other people and she says, look, wait a second. This doesn't make any sense. We're innocent bystanders. We should all die because we're harboring this guy. I understand logically why that makes sense, but why should we all die? Let's give him over. So she goes over to the wall and she says to Yoav, she says, Yoav, do you have any issue with us? He says, I got no issue with you. If we give you Sheva ben Bichri, will you leave us alone? He says, sure, I'll leave you alone. I got no problem with you. So what does she do? Here in Pasuk Chav Beis, the woman comes to all the people, and they do something very simple. They cut off the head of Sheva ben Bichri, they throw it to Yoav, and everybody is happy.
Except
four. Well, Sheva ben Bichri admits this ignominious demise, yes, which was coming to him as a rebellious, treacherous man. Right, I don't know if that made a difference unless they felt that, well, remember there was a siege, so they either had to throw him over the wall. It was probably more expedient just to throw his head over the wall. Just saying. Well, the answer is because this man, and this is what exactly what the Talmud Yerushalmi is debating, this man was actually liable to the death penalty, and a death penalty, by the way, that did not need to be meted out in a Jewish court of law because he was a treasonous rebel. Morid b'malchus doesn't need to be brought to court with two witnesses with the whole nine yards. So the Talmud Yerushalmi says, look at this precedent. There was a case where the many were threatened and they were able to give over one man. Says the Talmud Yerushalmi two things. Number one, the Tosefta itself already said, that's because when Yoav knocked on their city, he didn't just say, give us a random person. He didn't say pick anybody. Who was he looking for?
One specific
guy. And Reb Shimon ben Lakish, Reish Lakish's opinion, says they're asking for a guy, just Stam, an ordinary guy, or why'd they ask for him? What's that?
Because he's bad.
He's bad. He's a criminal. He's a known convicted criminal. He was already Chayav Misa. He's already liable for the death penalty. So they're just handing him over. He had already been essentially tried and convicted. So Maimonides, and with this we're going to conclude the sources, because this is the source that so many later authorities keep coming back to. Maimonides is writing this code in Egypt in the 12th century. Easiest way to remember how long Maimonides lived? He lived just less than a half hour. Because he lived from 1135 till 1204. That's the easiest way to remember. Maimonides writes in the code along the lines of Reish Lakish. Nashim sha'amr lahem ovdei kochavim, This is in the fifth chapter of the fifth law in the book of Yesodei HaTorah, the foundations of Judaism. A horde of bandits comes, they say, give us one random woman, don't give her over. And similarly, if they say, give us one man, don't give it over. If they designated that person, give us this person, or we will kill you all. If he was liable for the death penalty like Sheva ben Bichri, then yitnu also. Then you give him. And not only that, the Rambam says, ve'ein morin lahem kein lechatchila. You don't even tell people to do that a priori. But if that person is not chay of misa, says Maimonides, yehargu kulam, they should all die. Va'al yimsu lahem nefesh achas misra.
Not a great answer.
Well, it depends. It depends how you measure great. Meaning,
no. I'm saying in terms of
numbers, doesn't help you numbers wise. But why do numbers not matter? We had the answer already before. Because if you understand that every soul has infinite value, then infinite plus infinite comes back to the same infinite. So I want to tell you two stories. The first one appears in the autobiography Kar Arba Arava of Yehoshua Abishitz. We've mentioned him before in this meeting because he's a cousin of Faye Levinson's.
Wow. Okay.
So I actually, she gave me his number. I spoke to him once on the phone. He describes how in Chol HaMoed Sukkos in 1941, and he has in his autobiography, I have four pages here, I didn't give it to you because it's in Hebrew. The rabbis sitting, discussing, putting together the lists, who is going to be marked with a P, who is going to be marked with a U. They didn't know what P was, what U was. It was still very early. And how the rabbis debated this, it describes how the head of the Yudin Rab came to the rabbis. They had never had a question like this. It describes that they knew there was something dangerous, but they didn't know exactly what it meant. They decided they were going to discuss it. Then they had to discuss it the next day. They started discussing it at 10 o'clock in the morning. It gives the names of the people. He said they struggled because they didn't know the reality. They didn't know what P meant and what U meant. It continued until late into the night, and they couldn't come to a decision. They couldn't come to a decision because they didn't have clear facts. They said, we're going to discuss it again tomorrow. So the next day, broken, he says, shattered and broken, the rabbis came to a decision. This was later, it was on the 6th of November, 1941. And they came up with a psak that they could come, the Judenrat could come up with a list, but that every person in their community had to sign off on the list. Had to agree to it. Everyone had the right to review it. And he discusses the various terms. Another primary source, Alei Moros, the Hebrew journal of Rabbi Aronson, later became the rabbi in Petah Tikva. So he has two sections. He has the first section in his book, and you see it's printed on paper like this because it's like a diary. It's called Megillat Beit Ha'avadim. The Megillah of the Servitude. That's when he was in a work camp called Kunin. And later, in his kind of reflections in the section, he describes the Aktia B'machane Kunin in Sivan 1942, where they had to come up with a list of 160 people. He comes up with the name of rabbis. And he says they came to him to ask. He says, I explained to the Judenrat that according to the halacha, it is prohibited to give names on a list to the Germans. What does he quote? The Mishnah that we read in Maseches Trumos. And then he concludes with the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah. He says, tragically, they had already decided, and they were going to, and they did publish the list, and they took the people away. But you should know, he says, that I told them that you could not make a list. And what we learn, perhaps, is that there is a distinction, according to this approach in the Jewish tradition, between an act of hatzala, of saving, versus an act of handing over to the death. That is the conclusion that we draw, which is quite
fascinating.
Exactly, that is quite fascinating. And what we see is that even though you could argue that from a utilitarian number standpoint, one would be better, but I wonder, now I'm going to speak speculatively, you can tell me if you agree or not, part of it goes back to what Pierre said before of the infinite worth of every individual, and so infinite versus infinite. But there is another element here, perhaps, which is that the halacha, the Jewish law, distinguishes between an action of saving versus an action of destroying a life. From the end result, they're going to be the same. But perhaps what the halacha is telling us is that our spiritual makeup, our responsibilities as human beings, as Jews, as followers of the tradition, is to maintain a certain standard for ourselves. And that to hand over one person who is not liable for the death penalty, who was never indicated by somebody else, that is an act of cruelty. That is an act of murder. And even though on some utilitarian level you could justify it, but mitzad the gavra, mitzad the person, we shouldn't become the murderers. We can't stoop to that. I saw an amazing observation. Rav Yehuda Amital, his name was Klein when he lived in Europe. He was in a work camp. He said, you know what bracha he used to make? Again, this is not comparing, but it's just... He said, you know what bracha used to make with a lot of kavana? What blessing used to say with a lot of intent? Shelo asani goy. That God didn't make me a Gentile. That's the bracha. When he looked at the Germans, that's the bracha that he used to make. Because he said, I would rather be among the murdered than among the murderers.
Is that applicable to some other sorts? When it comes to when you were given the option of converting or not converting, if you're told you can join us or we will kill you, your option is one, you let yourself be killed. If you're told rape this woman or I will kill you, I remember being told very clearly, you let yourself be killed.
If that woman is a married woman, for sure.
Well, I didn't know the distinction.
Right. There's three cardinal ones. One is idol worship, conversion
right.
to another religion. Another one is murder. And the third one is any type of sexual immorality.
Right.
So those are three examples.
And when you see that or hear that, you could, at least for me, I can understand some of the choices that have to be made and the direction that we're taking based on those guidelines. I'm not saying that it's applicable to us. I'm just saying...
Exactly. That's what is... What Shale is pointing out, what is at the basis of this, is that destroying a life, that is of the most severe, that's the capital, what they call the Gimel Chamuros. So it is better for a group of people to give up their own lives, you see, even a group, than to actually kill somebody else. And I'm wondering if maybe the rationale for that on some level, obviously, that's a divine law, that's passed down through generations, but some of the rationale may be that we should never become the murderers. And that's why perhaps there's a difference between killing someone versus saving others. When it comes to saving, you could say, look, I'm saving this person. This is an act of hatsala. Now, we don't have time today. There is a very fascinating ethical dilemma that is raised by the Chazon Ish. The trolley experiment, we're running out of time for that. But just to understand, even someone like Rumkowski, the way that they couch their decisions, they viewed it as an act of hatsala. I'm saving. Whereas the rabbinic approach, by and large, not exclusively, but the majority of responses, certainly once they knew what they were saying, is that we have a tradition, and that is Yehareg va'al ya'avor. You cannot kill someone even if it means giving up your own life. And therefore, they said it would not be permitted in the majority of cases that to collaborate, it would be better. And that's why, if you know, when Adam Chernikov, he committed suicide. So that's a separate question, which we could do another day. But the idea that he would not, ultimately, at the end of the day, he would not collaborate with them. Yes, last comment.
So, I mean, we discuss a lot the differences between Adam Chernikov and Chaim Rumkowski, because you've got the two big ghettos, and they have two very different styles, and you go back and forth. And in the end of the day, correct me if I'm mistaken, there were more survivors from the Lodz ghetto than there were from the Warsaw ghetto, I think. And so even though he was so hated, in the end, I believe he succeeded.
I can't answer that question.
You have to leave that to an expert historian. Percentage or something, but they were saying that he was more successful in keeping people alive at the end of the war, like by the end of the war, than those that came out.
I would leave that up to the historians, because I can't say with any measure of authority who was more successful or not. But what we're seeing from this, and this is, I think, one important takeaway, is that the question of what the halacha calls upon the person is not necessarily a question of the aggregate number at the end of the day. It's how you live your life at any given moment. And so it almost doesn't matter whether Rumkowski was more successful and less successful. If the halacha dictates, now there's a lot of discussion here in these later books, did he consult rabbis, did he listen to them, was he just doing it for show, in addition to all of his other complications. But the halacha has this approach, and therefore the result, the end result, doesn't necessarily matter. But this is a core question that I think is worth considering, certainly from a spiritual standpoint, that was very common, but unfortunately they had to deal with.